Dr. Susanna Kokkonen, originally from Finland, welcome, is the director of the Christian Friends of Yad Vashem at the International Relations Division of Yad Vashem since April 2008. Since January 2010, she also holds the additional position of country director for Italy within Yad Vashem's International Relations Division. In her position, Dr. Kokkonen is responsible for Yad Vashem's many activities and contacts connected to the Holocaust, commemoration, and education. The activities include enrollment of new friends and partners for Yad Vashem's many projects and responsibility for a newly established International Christian Leadership Seminar. She travels around the world to speak about Israel, the Holocaust, and anti-Semitism. She has been the featured guest speaker at many Jewish Christian interfaith events. In 2009, she was the speaker at the official Holocaust Memorial Day of Northern Ireland, hosted by the First Minister's Office. She speaks six languages. She also writes regularly on Jewish and Israeli issues. Prior to Yad Vashem, she worked at the European Parliament in Brussels, Belgium, and at the Embassy of Finland in Tel Aviv. She received her PhD from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem in 2004 in Holocaust studies, and her topic for her dissertation was Jewish refugees of post-war Italy, 1945 to 51. So we'd like to welcome Dr. Susanna Kokkonen.
When we think about the Holocaust, we mostly think about the people in their striped pajamas, starving, weak, separated by a multitude of languages from each other, unable to resist. But what happens is that no society comes to this kind of period without a preparation. We don't come out of the blue to extermination of human beings. And I would like to take this time this morning, and I would like to describe to you that road to the Holocaust. What was there before the Holocaust and how we came to that time? When we describe the Holocaust or any genocide, we use the pyramid. And that is to indicate that there always has to be the foundation at the bottom before we come to that tiny little part at the top. So in the case of the Holocaust, we would have the anti-Jewish attitudes, the anti-Semitism that existed in Europe. We would come up and we would have the discrimination that governments sanctioned. And then a little bit up, we would have anti-Jewish action, and this would be violations like attacking Jewish cemeteries or synagogues. And only that tiny little part at the top is the mass murder. But you see, the foundation has to be there. And that is also the time when people have the possibility to act. And therefore, I believe that it's very important for us to look at this history to understand how the Holocaust came to happen. And there is such a clear connection between anti-Semitism and the Holocaust that really goes to show to us how easily these attitudes lead to action. When we think about anti-Semitism, we speak about it as the longest hatred. But actually, traditional anti-Semitism is based on Christian religious ideas. The idea that Jews were responsible for the killing of Jesus and therefore deserved to be punished was very prominent. It was part of the church teaching and theology. Another concept that was very strong in the churches was what we today call the replacement theology, the belief that the church had taken the position of Israel in the plans of God. And because the Jewish people had failed as a chosen people, it was the duty of Christians to be part of the punishment they deserved. And there was a blood libel, the meat that Jews used, the blood of Christian children in their Passover rituals. And even during the Inquisition, when initially the goal was for Jews to convert to Christianity, that was no guarantee that they could live. If they had converted, anybody could go and spy on them to see if they still celebrate the Shabbat. Or anybody bearing a grudge against a Jew could go to the Inquisition and say that these people are still celebrating the Shabbat, and they would be taken to a horrible death. I could go on and on, but let us come to a more modern time just before the Holocaust, the 19th century, the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment was a philosophical movement based on reason and accompanied by social progress. The Western European governments at the time gave Jews their civil rights, and that really started social and economic advancement in the Jewish communities of Western Europe. Many, many people hated this. The people who were against the Enlightenment said that Jews could never be loyal citizens of their nation states. And they actually accused the Jews of starting this Enlightenment movement. And what happens is that we have anti-Semitic incidents so often that we know that governments have been unable to change the hearts and minds of people. Anti-Semitism remains a potent idea in people's minds. In Eastern Europe, violent pogroms take place all the time, and in Russia, Jew hatred is the official policy of the state. During the 1870s, this anti-Semitism that was religious and political was compounded by what we call the racial anti-Semitism. There were new ideas of evolution expressed, for example, by Charles Darwin, who never meant for these ideas to be taken to this political context. But Jew haters now began saying that Jews were an inferior race. And this, of course, could never be changed. You can change your religion, but you can't change your racial identity. And now they started saying that the world's troubles, whether economic or political, were caused by the Jewish race. And it is at this time when we first hear the word anti-Semitism. Until then, these people had called themselves Jew haters, but now they were anti-Semites, referring to the Semitic language Hebrew. And this was a way of giving anti-Semitism a scientific basis. The Nazi Party then was one of the first political movements that was totally based on racist anti-Semitism. And this was the case from even before they gained political power. And I think what is really important for us to realize here before we enter into the Nazi Party and that period, that despite these ongoing persecutions and discriminations in Europe, Jews throughout the centuries had contributed to the economy, to the culture, to the societies where they lived in. Even in Eastern Europe, where there was strong segregation and Jewish communities were separated because they spoke Yiddish and lived in a more conservative community, barriers had been broken down. And in Western Europe, Jews moved to positions of influence in their societies. In 1866, the Berlin Synagogue was inaugurated, and Otto von Bismarck, the German Chancellor himself, participated in the ceremony, and this was seen as a sign of how Jews had entered the mainstream society. But behind this success, there was always this spirit of anti-Semitism just waiting for the right moment. World War First ended in Germany's defeat, and the imperial regime was now replaced by a republic we call the Weimar Republic. And it is something very interesting we see in this period. We see people like Albert Einstein, the composer Arnold Schoenberg, people who become very prominent. And these are all Jews, and they are very, very important in the cultural and scientific life in Germany. But at the same time, we see anti-Semitism growing rapidly. Jews are now for the first time in very important political positions in this new republic. Perhaps you have heard of the first foreign minister, Walter Rathenau, who was actually killed, assassinated by right-wing radicals in 1922. His assassination was the culmination of the anti-Semitism that was going on one side of the society. And when the Ostjuden, the Jews from Eastern Europe, at the same time started immigrating to Germany in the hope of better life, they stood out. They were traditional. They wore the traditional clothing. And this became the theme of all anti-Semitic propaganda at that time. Now, the Nazi Party had been founded in 1919 in Bavaria, in southern Germany. And its very platform from the beginning called for the elimination of Jews from all spheres of life. The propaganda speeches by the party leaders, especially Adolf Hitler, presented a very radical anti-Semitic ideology that called for the extermination of the Jews. And here we have to realize that this was not a normal European nationalist movement, because the Nazi Party managed to make the Jewish question, what they called the Jewish question, such a central theme that they were going to clean, purify the human society, not only Germany. And it is very interesting that for the first time in history, we see a political party coming to power, and they have a new theme, the Jew hatred, the anti-Semitic theme. And this becomes the major question. They managed to do something that nobody had done before, to bring this question into political arena and use it against the democratic regime that was in power. Now, why was this so prominent? Why was this question so important? How many Jews do you think were living in Germany at the time? In 1925, there was a census that was conducted in Germany, and it turned out that the Jews were less than 1% of the total population of the country, less than 600,000 people. They were very assimilated. They mostly belonged to the middle classes, and even most of their marriages were with non-Jews. And yet, anti-Semitism became the central question. In the final years of the Weimar Republic, Germany was hit by a global economic crisis. In 1928, there were elections, and Nazis won only 3% of the vote. And then you remember 1929, the economic crisis becomes global. So in the next election, following the economic crisis, they won 37% of the vote. And they became the largest political party. And this is a time when anti-Semitism started to have a profound effect on the Jews in Germany. And it is not only because the synagogues were attacked, it's not only because of the Nazi propaganda, but their sense of security, their sense of belonging to that country, they themselves started to question it in that time. And they really started re-examining their Jewish identity. And so we come to 1933. In January 1933, Hitler becomes the Chancellor of Germany. And because of the economic crisis, there is a special law in effect that grants him wide-reaching powers. And I want you to consider that in March 1933, less than 2 months later, the first anti-Jewish violent riots took place all over Germany. At the same time, the concentration camp of Dachau was opened. Now, when the concentration camp was opened, at that time it was not yet for the Jews. Socialists, communists, liberals. Anybody who could form an opposition to Hitler was taken into the concentration camp. Already in April 1933, we have the first organized anti-Jewish boycott targeting Jewish businesses, shops, and so on. May 1933, we have books burned all over Germany. By June 1933, less than 6 months have passed, 27,000 people have been detained by the regime. September 1935, Germany becomes what we call the racial state, because Jews by law are now turned into second-class citizens. And I want to point out to you that something had changed very quickly in the society. Jewish children were not immediately expelled from the public schools, but we know that a number of Jewish children left schools in 1933 because they were ostracized. By whom? Of course, by other children, but more importantly, by their teachers, by the principals of the schools. And when a Jewish person would now go into a government office when they required something, they would not deserve that, they would not get the treatment they had get before. So we see how the propaganda very quickly turned the views of people. And I would like to point out to you another very important development. As soon as the Nazi Party came into power, they started a program of sterilizations. In other words, anybody who would give birth to a child with a hereditary disease or genetic condition would not be allowed to do so. People were sterilized forcibly. And then between 1936 to 1939, medical doctors were required to report to the authorities on children that had been born previously or were born then with hereditary disease, different conditions. Thousands of these children were taken to be killed by lethal injection or gas, and many of them lived actually in church-supported institutions. And I want you to consider this. Who did the killing of these children? Those were medical doctors. And research actually shows that they never had any doubts about what they were doing. How could that be? Well, first of all, they were not doing anything illegal. The law was on their side. And second of all, they had no moral doubts because the church did not tell them that they needed to have. You see, what happens is that we have individual pastors and priests who say that this murder program is immoral and it's against the Bible, but we don't ever have anybody excommunicated. There is no strong feeling that you cannot be a Christian and participate in this program. And so we actually see that this euthanasia program, mercy killings program, killed 275,000 Germans, is a forerunner to the Holocaust. If people did not speak up when their own children were taken, were they going to speak up for the Jews? No. And that is how we come to 1938, and the historians call this the fateful year. 1938 is an important year because by that time Germany was a one-party country. There was only one single party, and this party controlled every aspect of the citizens' lives. The country was clearly being prepared to war. And also, Jews had now been firmly separated from the rest of the society. And I want you to consider this. When Jews lost their positions, when they could not work in those civil service professions or as medical practitioners and so on, this was not only an economic measure. It was an economic measure because it deprived people of their livelihood. And it certainly encouraged Jews to leave Germany. But more than that, it was a way of creating an invisible barrier between Germans and Jews. And if you are going to murder people, there has to be that barrier. So in 1938, Jewish passports were confiscated, and those who needed a passport for any reason had a J on it, so that they would instantly be recognized as Jews. In October 1938, Jews with Polish citizenship were transported into the border area between Germany and Poland. Nobody wanted them. They were starving. They were living in terrible conditions in that border area. One of them sent a letter to his son in Paris describing what was happening. On November 7th, this son killed a German diplomat in Paris. And so we have the Kristallnacht, the night of the broken glass, taking place November 9th, 1938. Only here we have a problem. The Nazis wanted to describe it as a spontaneous reaction because of the murder of the German diplomat. But we know that the violence started already earlier. All over Germany, we know that the first synagogues were burned before November 9th. And so what we know is that the Nazi leaders at the time were gathered in Munich to celebrate a former coup by Hitler. And they sent instructions all over Germany that Jewish synagogues were going to be burnt down, property was going to be looted, and so forth. And in a matter of hours, this happened. Synagogues were burning all over Germany. And we have one church leader saying publicly in Berlin that synagogues too are houses of God. One man spoke up. And I know that it's very easy to see the Kristallnacht as a night of hooliganism and vandalism and so on, but I really think that it was the beginning of the end. We are coming so close to the tip of the pyramid that it's going to be impossible for people to resist the evil. And this evil did not start in the place where it ended. It had started centuries ago. And I would like to read to you from Israel Gutman, a Holocaust survivor and historian. This is what he said about this. The Jews were convinced that things could not get worse. The truth is that every stage was something worse and more terrible. This dynamic is the very essence of terror. By the time of the Kristallnacht, Western powers know that something terrible is going on in Germany with regard to the Jews. So what do? They decide to close their gates from Jewish refugees. In July 1938, there was an international conference of governments called the Evian Conference. And the aim of this conference was to solve the refugee problem. And the solution was that the gates would be closed. The Jews were not welcome anywhere. In May 1939, a ship sails from Germany, full of refugees. They had a permission to embark in Cuba, Havana. But on the last moment, the government there decided not to allow them. So they came to the United States. They appealed to Eleanor Roosevelt and many other important people, but were turned away. So the ship had to return to Germany. And although some European governments decided to accept some of the refugees, we know now that most of them were murdered in the Nazi final solution, because even those European countries were eventually occupied by Nazi Germany. And if we want to think about the road to the Holocaust, now we have arrived, 1939. September 1939, Hitler attacks Poland, and Europe's largest Jewish community is under Nazi authority. So what had been in the mid-1930s a theoretical goal is now closer to becoming reality. And immediately, as soon as Germans entered Poland, they started deporting Jews from their homes, driving them to the ghettos, from where it would be easier to take them to the places where they were going to be murdered. And I want you to consider this. Imagine now that Germans arrive, let's say, to Warsaw, and Jews have to leave their homes. They have a few hours. They can take a limited amount of goods with them. What is going to happen to the homes they leave behind? Somebody's going to get a new home. Somebody is going to benefit from that property. And that somebody is going to become part of the crime. If you benefit from the property of these people, are you going to complain when they are being murdered? No. You are complicit in the crime. And this is exactly what happened. This is exactly what was done. What we actually define as the Holocaust is the time between June 1941 and the end of the World War II, between the Soviet invasion and the end of World War II. First, when the German troops entered the Soviet Union, they had with them Einsatzgruppen, and these were special groups whose only task was to follow the army and kill any Jews they encountered. So they were murder squads. But of course, this could never have been done in Western Europe. It could be done in Eastern Europe because people were eager to get rid of the Jews and they didn't mind. We know that there were men who went with women to have a date by watching how Jews were being murdered. So the Germans realized that killing in this manner was not going to be a solution, and that is when they decided that in Eastern Europe they were going to build special extermination centers, and the Jews from Western Europe often had to pay, and this is for sure true with Scandinavia and Northern Europe, had to pay for their own train ticket. Sometimes they were upgraded to the first class. But it didn't matter, because whether they arrive in the cattle car or sitting in the first class, they suffered the same fate. And I could tell you the stories of so many countries. Throughout 1942, the Jews of Poland were transported to extermination camps. March 1942, 60,000 Slovak Jews were deported to Poland to meet a similar fate. After Germany occupied Hungary, the same happened there, and this is very important, and I want to mention it, that even when the Allies had already landed in Normandy, Jews from Budapest were still forced into trains, taken to Auschwitz, and murdered immediately. And why is this antisemitism part so important? Why did I spend so much time describing the background of antisemitism? Because in so many countries in Europe, it was the prevalent antisemitism that prevented people from acting. Even in Western Europe, where there was more freedom to act and where the Germans were more careful of their actions, the antisemitic feelings of the people inhibited them from acting even when they could have acted on behalf of the Jews. And the collaboration with the Germans took many forms. There were governments that gave their power over to the Germans. There were people who assisted the German military in occupying their own country. There were people who led the German army against the partisan fighters. And there were many who chose to give up the Jews. And I would like us to take a look at Netherlands, because the percentage of Jews who were deported to the death camps from Western European countries was very high there. Out of the 140,000 Jews who lived there, 77% were murdered. And this is a very, very big number. Now, about 25,000 Jews were assisted by Dutch citizens, taken into hiding. But over 8,000 out of them were turned in by Dutch collaborators. And then, of course, there was the silent collaboration. Silent bystanders become part of the crime, because silence is never going to work for the benefit of the victim. It always helps the perpetrator of the crime. So when people stood by and they said, well, I haven't done anything wrong, I haven't done anything, but that is a part of the crime. Perpetrators of the crimes require the silent bystanders. Now, I know that when we think about the Holocaust, we think about 6 million people, and it's a number that is so large that it's impossible for us to comprehend. It's impossible. So we have to somehow think about an individual. We have to somehow remember that these people, they had lives before the Holocaust. They were members of families, members of communities. They were religious, non-religious, children, adults, grandfathers, grandmothers. At the center, we have to see an individual, and we have to realize that this was not the crime that was committed against numbers. This was a crime that was committed against people. And I really feel that when we think about today, what is happening in the world today, and when we think about anti-Semitism, we see that the same things that were being said of the Jews before the Holocaust are now being said about the state of Israel. The state of Israel is today's Jew, the Jewish community. And if you look at the news media around the world, it almost doesn't matter where. It seems like this tiny little state is causing all the trouble, all the human rights violations, terrorism, you name it, they are guilty. And what does it mean to us today? This whole story, if we see it as history, then it has no meaning because it doesn't teach us anything. No, I think we have to take it into today. And we have to realize that we have a responsibility not to be silent bystanders in the time we live in. Just imagine that there is a president of a UN member country threatening Israel with genocide, and he is a guest of honor in the UN. The international community seems to be powerless. The state of Israel is again being threatened by genocide, and the world is standing by to a large extent, either hoping that Israel will take care of the problem, or just not caring, believing that as long as we are safe, it doesn't matter. And what does God want to say to us at this time? I know what he is saying to me, and I really believe that there are words in the Bible that were written to other people at other time, and suddenly they become relevant to the time where we live in. Think about Esther and Mordechai. Think about what was happening in the same geographical area at that time. And what did Mordechai say to Esther? He said, if you at this time remain silent, salvation to the Jews will come from another place, but you and your house will perish. And this is the challenge for the churches and for us today as believers, not to remain silent. Thank you.